Welcome to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. It's a podcast about movies and wine. For those of you who don't know shit about either of those topics, I am Scott. I am the movie guy. My co-host Jamie is the wine guy. Normally, each episode, we pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves. We tell you and each other why we like them, how they're made, and why we think they work. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. Sometimes we do not. Last week, of course, we went very long talking about 2014's Edge of Tomorrow. Today, we're going to go equally verbose on the wine side of things to find out what Jimbo paired with that wacky alien invasion, time loop, war, comedy, Looney Tune, Tom Cruise vehicle. So, without further ado, I'll turn it over to Past Scott and Past Jamie and their conversation that is already in progress. Jamie, I told you many things about this movie.
Yes.
To get you to pair a wine.
You rambled on about this.
At great length.
Yeah.
As I'm about to do again.
I struggled mightily to find a bottle to pair with this movie, but I landed on one.
You did.
I did.
Yeah.
So this is Decibel. Gimlet Gravels, Malbec, 2017. Gimlet Gravels is a small little area in Hawke's Bay, New Zealand, that is on the North Island of New Zealand. Decibel was founded in 2009 by Daniel Brennan, a Philly boy. His great-grandfather emigrated from Sicily, was a winemaker and a cooper. His family has owned McCrossin's Tavern. Any of our Philly listeners likely have been to McCrossin's, and if you haven't, you should. It's right there on 20th Street in the Fairmount neighborhood. It's pretty rad. He grew up there from busser to GM. Then ended up managing a band called Seeking Homer for about 5 years before falling in love with New Zealand wine, deciding that he did not, in fact, want to be in the restaurant industry because it is not sustainable to live your life that way, and went to go make wine. Gimlet Gravels is famous for Syrah and Bordeaux-style blends. Malbec, as I mentioned in our previous episode, is a Bordeaux variety. It's part of that family of grapes, but not a lot of varietal Malbec gets made in New Zealand. This is honestly the only one that I know of, although I'm sure that there are a couple others. Daniel gets all of the grapes for this cuvée from a small single vineyard. Gimlet Gravels is a really cool place. Obviously, gravel soil. Maybe not obviously, but it is in the name.
Yeah, nothing about the label was obvious to me in my little wine folly journal where, you know, my dear pal Madeline asked me to write down the producer, the name, the classification, the variety, the subregion, the region, the country, and the vintage.
Yes.
Only country and vintage and varietal were very clear to me. So Decibel is the producer?
The producer, correct.
And not the name of the wine.
That's correct.
All right. And it's obviously a Malbec. And Gimlet Gravels is not the producer, is the region.
That is correct.
Or is it the
sub-region?
The sub-region.
The region,
and the region
is
Hawke's Bay.
Yep.
And the country is New Zealand.
That's right.
And the color is red.
That's correct.
And the flavor is bold and delicious.
Yes.
Grand.
Yes, it is.
I am very clear now. Thank you.
I think the wine's great. It is, as you said, bold. It's really intensely structured. It hits all of the notes that I want from a Malbec, meaning that like it's kind of blue-fruited and it has a nice earthiness to it, but the thing that Malbec does that can sometimes give it a negative reputation when it comes from Argentina is that it gets a little bit flabby and formless, and I think that this wine's structure really holds it together. It's beautiful both with or without food. I really love it. I've had this on wine lists that I've run for the last decade, partly because of the Philly connection. Daniel's a really cool dude. He does frequent trips to Philly. I also like the name of the wine, Decibel, is just a nod to his former career as a band manager, but also his initials. He would always sign it DB, lowercase d, uppercase b, as the abbreviation for Decibel.
That's very clever.
Yep. I'm okay with that. I'll allow it.
I'm just, all right. All right. All right. All right. All right, Jamie, we've talked a lot about this movie,
yes,
which is, I think, at times superlative. Tell me about this wine, which is red and delicious and full of flavor and boldness and body.
It does. It's
I
got
have
a full,
very confident feelings about the body.
It's got
this
a full
time.
Body. It's true. This wine's delicious. It's very, very good.
It smells good, too.
It smells good. It tastes good. Makes you feel good. That last part is the alcohol content.
I was going to say that's regardless of the wine, right?
Right.
That's just, yeah.
The sense of euphoria that
right.
ethyl alcohol
that
gives
all,
you.
Yeah. Yeah. But killing my brain cells.
That's right.
Yeah. And reducing my reaction time.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a talking point here that I want to get into, but maybe we lead in here with your notes from your fancy little wine folly journal.
My little wine folly journal.
Yeah.
Well, let's turn the page here. So we have already unpacked the first of several questions on my journal here, which is who made it and which of the words on the label tell me who and where and what.
We've unpacked all of that. The biggest one there is the producer. It says decibel.
I have not found that to be the way every time.
It's not the way. It's mostly the way in non-European wines.
There you go. You got it.
Typically, producer is first. And in European wines, typically, region will be the thing that's the biggest.
Right. Between this wine's label and the various key art for the movie, we have some pretty confusing titling, I think, going on.
I'm not confused.
Well, I don't know. Shut up, Jamie. I had thoughts. I had thoughts on thoughts. Again, just looking at the little charts on Madeline's journal here. The look would be a deep red on the spectrum of reds. Deep. The intensity, rather.
Yeah, deep for sure.
Deep.
Yes.
And then for the hue, somewhere between a purple and a ruby.
Yeah, I think this is firmly purple.
I don't know. The highlights are ruby, though. When it catches the light, it's much redder than purple.
Sure, that's splitting hairs, though.
Okay, I mean, fine.
I live to split hairs, so.
I was going to say, what the fuck else are we doing here if we're not splitting what four hairs we have left between the two of us on top of our heads?
We both have more than four hairs.
Not that many. So the smell. I was getting a funk like fish sauce.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cranberries, dark cherries. I don't know what you call them, but the cherries where the skins are dark.
Yeah, black cherry.
Black cherries and blueberries. These were all on the nose. Then, in the tasting realm, well, first of all, body, I was saying, do you think it's full body?
Yeah.
Now, she doesn't do, on the chart here, she goes from light to medium to bold. Full is bold?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
I thought it was a medium body. You think it's like super body?
Maybe medium plus is what I would call it. You know, it's not like so incredibly mouth-filling. It's a little bit lithe.
Lithe, that is a very good word to use to describe wine that I do not understand at all what you mean by it.
I know.
That's fine. High on the tannins. I was getting high tannins. Maybe not mega tannins, but at least medium plus to high.
Medium plus is what I would say.
All right. Acidity in red wine continues to confound me. So tell me, is it low acid?
I think this is medium.
Because I guess I was salivating a little bit.
Yeah.
I am now, but that's only because there's a microphone in front of me and my body wants to sabotage me at all times. Alcohol, we know it's a 13%. And sweetness, this wine is dry.
Yes, it is.
Will we say it's bone dry or is it not that dry?
Just dry.
Just dry, just regular dry. And then for flavor notes, I was getting metal, like in the ballpark of copper.
Mm-hmm.
Tang, some kind of tang. Not like tang, the orange powdered NASA drink,
but like tangy.
A little tangy. Something in the ballpark of steak sauce.
I was going to say hoisin sauce.
Hoisin sauce, that's a good one. Hoisin sauce is good. I wrote this down in the wrong place, but I did note regular old wine smell. Though I guess I don't know how regular it is since I had very specific notes otherwise to go along with it. And then hear me out here on the taste. I wrote down cherry compote, but I think what I mean specifically is any time that like cherries are cooked or baked, but maybe not with sugar being added to it, but like the taste of like cooked or baked cherries.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was thinking of compote, just like, you know, cherries and water and boiled for a while until it reduces and shit, like that kind of cherry, cooked or baked cherries.
I'm down with that.
Good.
Yeah.
I agree. Let's close the book on it.
So you like it?
Yeah, I like it a lot.
You texted me, yo, about this wine.
Yeah, I said yo.
And then you said yo again.
Right, because I wasn't going to, you know, spill the beans and give you any more information.
Why'd you spill your beans?
See, now you think it's funny. So here's my like first, probably my biggest question for you here. So I opened this the other night. I was just telling you this off mic. I poured a little splash and then decanted a bunch. Enjoyed the splash, knew it was going to be better after it breathed for a while. Decanted and shook it all, whatever, and then had like a big glass and loved it. And this was the yo text that I was giving you. And then I opened it not 2 days later, yesterday, and this fucking screw cap, this Delvin closure had been tight on it the entire time, and then I didn't really like it very much last night. So what is the, like, half-life on a bottle of wine once I've opened it?
It depends on the wine.
Damn it. Can't you give me a broad user-friendly answer here?
Well, here's the broad user-friendly answer, and you're not going to like this.
Is just open it and drink the entire bottle.
Listen, it is packaged in one bottle package. That means that's one serving.
Yeah.
That's what that means.
That's what that means,
Scott.
Jamie, would you like a whole gallon of milk?
If I could still drink milk, absolutely.
I believe internet has proven to you that you cannot drink an entire gallon of milk in one sitting.
Which is why I would buy it in half gallon. That's one serving.
All right.
You buy these things in servings. A box of cookies, that's one serving of cookies.
See, Scott. Now we're on a wavelength here. I agree. A box of Oreo with the three tubes
yep.
in the thing, that is one serving that's for one adult man not to share with his family.
Correct.
Okay, good. Great. Okay, so do you have an actual answer?
The not glib answer here.
Yes.
Because honestly, like usually when I open a bottle of wine, I
pour the entire thing into your gullet.
I either drink the bottle that day or I consume it over 2 days. Okay. I very rarely will I go 3 or 4 days with it open.
Yeah.
For me, 2 glasses of wine is like basically not even a thing to think about. Like I'll have 2 glasses of wine and that's fine. And that's half a bottle. The better answer here is that things that have more sulfur in them, things that are more conventionally produced will have a better half-life open.
Because of like preservatives?
Yeah.
Is the sulfur a preservative? Sulfur is a preservative,
yeah.
I'm sure we've talked about that on this show before.
Sulfur both is an antibacterial, an antifungal, and also an antioxidant. And oxidation is the thing that happened to your bottle of wine over 2 days.
That's the enemy.
Yeah. If I know that I'm not going to get to that bottle within the next couple of days.
Yeah. You'll use your thing.
I have a Coravin. Yeah. So I'll spray some argon into the bottle and then recork it.
And this works because argon is a neutral gas and you spray it in and the argon displaces the oxygen and then you can cork it and that's how that works.
That's right.
And I totally understand that easily and handily on the first time without you even needing to explain it to
me. That's correct, yes.
And we definitely didn't do 15 minutes of shtick about this one time before because I fundamentally did not understand how your device worked.
Right, and I still don't think that you do understand how it works.
No, but I think I have a pretty good grip on it now.
But you did a good job. Yeah. The short answer, man, is like over my career, the long answer is over my career.
Jesus Christ, that wasn't the long answer?
The long answer is over my career, I've tasted a lot of wines and specifically with an eye for building either by the bottle or by the glass lists, right? By the bottle list, I'm not concerned about whether the wine can stand up over a couple of days open.
Right, because you don't care once they've bought it.
Well, once you're sitting in a restaurant, you finish the bottle, usually.
Right, but if they don't, you don't care because they've already bought the
bottle.
Correct. You're not sitting on inventory that's
going to go bad. That's their responsibility, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, like you care that they enjoy the wine and whatever, but yeah.
But financially, business-wise, I don't. You're right.
Yeah.
By the glass, I very much care. And so I think about, well, do I think that this wine will hold up over a period of time? And I've been wrong enough times to sort of have a feeling for which wines are going to last open and which wines won't.
Does that factor into buy the glass prices? Opening a new bottle to pour a glass, you are now essentially like putting the rest of that bottle at risk of not being ordered and therefore oxidizing more quickly, right?
Yes.
So on wines, like, do you factor that in when you're making a list? Like,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, the accepted wisdom is that you have to make more money. Your theoretical cost of goods sold have to be better on by the glass than by the bottle.
Right.
Because there's that risk built in.
Yeah, there's more opportunity for loss.
Practically, the way I've run lists is what it means is by the bottle, I am typically hovering between 30 and 40% cost of goods sold. And on by the glass, typically hovering between 22 and 28%. Short answer being is you go into a restaurant, buy a bottle, you get a better deal.
But what if I don't want a whole bottle? What if I demonstrably can't drink a whole bottle in one sitting?
Then you take the economic hit.
There we go. All right. That's a compromise. That's reasonable. That's responsible. And it doesn't advocate excessive drinking. There we go. So anyway, that was my thing. Why did I not like it that much last night when I was nuts about it 2 days ago?
It oxidized. It changed.
So short of me buying a Coravin device,
yes.
I just need to drink my wines more quickly.
Yeah.
And so I should try and drink them within, what, like a 24-hour period, essentially?
I mean, that's the safest. Also, other ways to slow down the aging process. Make sure your closure is very tight.
Mm.
So there's no oxygen ingress. Like obviously, however much headspace is in there, that oxygen is already in the bottle and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
But preventing more from getting in there is helpful. But also refrigeration, because colder temperatures, there are fewer chemical reactions.
I didn't even think about that. So open a bottle, make sure it's sealed up tight, pop that John in the fridge.
Yep.
That's a good idea. How much did that Corvin cost you?
I got mine for free because...
You're a loss leader, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But what do those devices normally cost?
The like base, I think the one that is available right now is the Series 5. I want to say it's 200.
That's too much for me. But
you might get it, as someone who doesn't drink a whole bottle at a time, you might actually get significant use out of it.
Well, this is just like a thing that has happened a couple of times now. And I've gotten into this routine, especially as like we're recording further in advance, that I might watch the movie a full 2 weeks before the recording with the wine.
Right.
And then, you know, work on my notes and work on whatever other six episodes we have in the pipeline at the moment. And then maybe this happened a couple of times. Within a day or two of the recording, I'll go and watch it again, and I'll go and want to open the bottle up again. But then, like, that can be a major problem.
Yep.
All right. Cool. Learning. So now we've talked about this wine enough.
Yeah,
Let's play Wife Takes. Let's move along.
Wow, rude. I've got shit that I want to talk about.
Jamie has things he wants to say. Let us hear them.
Which is a shame because I said we were going to be under 2 hours on this episode and it ain't happening.
We're mistaken.
So mistaken. All right. What I want to talk about with this wine is the idea of New Zealand wine generally being brand new and also immediately stuck in a rut.
Okay.
What I mean by that is New Zealand wine didn't get a start really until the 1960s.
Right.
The late 60s. And even then, it didn't really get on its feet until the late 70s. Then it began to be a phenomenon in the late 80s.
Okay.
In the world of wine, that is an instant. You know, that is no time at all. That is one movie release.
In the world of wine?
Yeah.
The world of wine is slower than the world that the rest of us are living in?
Yes.
Because of how long it takes for anything to happen.
Well, you only get one chance to make a wine each year.
I guess that's a fair point.
It is a yearly cycle.
Right. So chances to like learn and iterate and change happen once a year.
The maximum number of vintages for a winemaker to live through is pretty small. You know, like if you are born into a winemaking family and you become head winemaker at, let's say, very charitably in your early 20s.
Sure.
You're going to retire by your 80s, right? So that leaves you maybe 60 vintages.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah.
That's not a lot.
Right.
And so change comes slowly. My point is that this is sort of a meteoric and incredibly quick change in the landscape of the wine world globally because New Zealand did what it did, but also it's basically just a blip in the history of wine. One could argue that there was some activity in the 19th century in New Zealand, but Prohibition lasted from 1911 until 1967, as we said last episode. So what I'm saying is in a very real way, when Montana purchased 2,900 acres in Marlborough in 1973, it was the very, very beginning of this industry. And immediately it was a monoculture. Immediately you have a huge number of vineyards popping up in Marlborough. 70%, the overwhelming majority of them, are planted to Sauvignon Blanc. The cool thing that's been happening in the 21st century is that smaller producers like Daniel Brennan of Decibel have been seeking out smaller specific sites or using different winemaking techniques to show a different perspective on New Zealand. Something that is not Sauvignon Blanc, or maybe not the stainless steel, zippy, grapefruity, Pirozzini Sauvignon Blanc that we all know about. This all comes from sort of the strength that is afforded by the big industry in New Zealand already.
Right. They sell so much fucking New Zealand Marlboro Sauvignon Blanc that other people can afford to take some risks.
Right.
Because the industry overall
is
a rising tide of boat lifting.
That is correct. Yeah. There are a ton of very well-educated winemakers. There is a lot of knowledge in the air and a culture of sharing that knowledge.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned to you off mic, and also in our previous episode, there's basically no bad wine that gets made in New Zealand.
There's no plonkers.
There's no plonk. There's no bulk wine. There's no jug wine.
Why isn't there, like, why hasn't somebody, that feels like a niche, right? That could be filled. Like, not a niche, but that feels like a market that could be satisfied. Is it just because it's so fucking small, there's not enough land?
Not only is it small, most of the land is incredibly rugged and not suitable for agriculture. Like, there is a tiny portion of this tiny nation that is suitable for agriculture.
Right. That's the Shire. And then the rest of it is like Mordor, right? I've seen those movies.
It's like Mordor or Rivendell or...
I guess Rivendell is too rocky and mountainous.
Correct.
Yeah.
And the forest realm where Galadriel lives. What's that place called?
That is Mirkwood.
Mirkwood. Is it?
No.
No.
Rivendell is where Elrond lives. Galadriel is woodland one of the realm. It might be Mirkwood. That is a realm of Middle Earth.
We're not looking this up.
No. The audience will just have to accept that nerds, we are not slide Tolkien into our scholars.
DMs and tell us, yeah, please.
Tolkien scholars, drop us a DM. Yeah, let us know.
There's just not a lot of land for agriculture. So what is there has to be capitalized on. And that's led to higher quality and higher prices. I think we both agree that higher quality or higher prices don't necessarily mean higher quality.
Yes.
But they can be an indicator. And I think it's telling that the average price for a bottle of New Zealand wine is $33, whereas the average price for a bottle of wine globally is $14.
And you don't think that's because the Kiwis are jacking up the prices. This is just about price being representative of quality.
Not just, but it is that.
Yeah.
It's not only price being representative of quality, but it is significantly that. It's also telling, you know, globally, entered into that global average are bottles of wine that cost $10,000 for 750 milliliters of wine. That does not exist on New Zealand. New Zealand, you'd be hard-pressed to find anything above $200.
Because the industry is so young that they don't have anything that's aged for that long?
And they don't have anything that has that kind of cachet.
Right. There's no old vines. There's no pre-phylloxera vines. Right. There's no crazy scarcity.
That's correct.
Yeah. That makes sense. That's weird to me. And this is maybe just me like being an American, but it is difficult for me to imagine any regional industry that doesn't have a room for like shitty products at bargain basement prices, you know?
And the flip side is they also don't have room for the super elite, mega, right, only rich people stuff. It's, yeah, kind of, it's all in the, what is called in wine circles, the premium slot, the like $15 to $35, right, price point.
The middle shelves.
Middle to top, because 35 can be top.
Hmm. But not ultra top.
Not like behind the counter in a glass case.
Right.
On this baseline of high quality, high knowledge base, you have exciting things happening. Not least of which, we've got Burn Cottage, which I mentioned last episode. There are a ton of producers in that area specifically. Central Otago is kind of a hotbed of exactly what I'm talking about. And then you have your kind of weirdos like Daniel Brennan, who are like, come here from Philadelphia because the band that they were managing petered out and they don't want to spend their lives in restaurants. So I guess I'll go make wine because I tasted a Martinborough Pinot Noir one time and I thought it was really great. The dude secretly got accepted into a wine school in New Zealand and just stayed there from 2008 on.
Secretly?
He didn't tell his family or his friends that he had applied. Oh, okay.
This wasn't like he overstayed his visa and just like stayed in country illegally. Okay.
All right. No. And I just think it's really cool that this kind of thing can happen.
Yeah.
It's inspiring. I think it's special. I think the perspective that an American in New Zealand brings to these wines is unique.
Yeah, that is interesting that he's an American expat working in this, you know, still up and coming wine culture. What Americanness do you think he's bringing to the Kiwi viticultural landscape?
The American brashness, right? The, like, I'm just going to go and do the damn thing. He just, without telling his friends or family, applied to a wine school and then was like, deuces, y'all, and never came back. And each time he is given an opportunity for a new source of fruit, he finds a way to enter it into his portfolio if it's compelling to him, to the point where now he's got three different labels. He makes the Decibel label, which is all single vineyard wines. He makes the Testify label, which is Appellation wines, but they're very, like, they're very specific and treated in a more premium way. Oak aging, and they're like, they're his top end cuvées. And then the Giunta label, which is his family's old name from Sicily, which is early drinking, easy, gluggable stuff. He makes a Malbec Nouveau because he wants to, and it's fun, and it's fruity and delicious. He hasn't pigeonholed himself into doing just one thing, and in fact, he does 10 things incredibly competently, and I think that sort of bluster is pretty American. The topic that I chose here doesn't really have parallels to the movie.
Well, so I mean, the bluster that you're talking about does sort of remind me of the unexpected success of the career of Doug Liman, the director.
Yeah.
Like, just as like a guy who doesn't have a distinct style, does not have a distinctive voice, has had a handful of hits and a handful of flops and a couple of movies that are completely anonymous to the point of like not existing. And he continues to get paid a lot of money to make very, very expensive movies. And I find his career utterly fascinating in a sense of like, how does this man continue to like bluster along?
It takes a lot of confidence in yourself, earned or not, to step into a higher stakes scenario, right?
Yeah.
Like putting your own label on a bottle of wine or taking, you know, a large budget and turning it into a big tentpole film.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't have imposter syndrome and tackle something at that scale.
I think you can quietly, privately.
Right.
Outwardly, you just have to forge forward. I mean, this guy had not even graduated from his wine school when he made his first vintage. He saw his opportunity. He took it. He said to himself, I will be making wine every year for the rest of my life. And he has.
I would love to have the confidence of that person.
Yeah, same.
That sounds great.
It does.
Did you ever hear the Mike Birbiglia, not anecdote, but his joke about becoming a movie director?
No.
Mike Birbiglia, the like stand-up comedian, he's directed two features now.
Okay.
The first of which is called Sleepwalk With Me. And it's like based on his experiences as a sleepwalker, but also all of his stand-up about like him and his wife dealing with his sleepwalking. But he has this great story about what he thought about the first time he decided he wanted to be a filmmaker. He said it's like getting on a bus and then going up to the bus driver and say, hey, I want to drive the bus today. And the bus driver and all the passengers are like, what? And he's like, no, don't worry about it. I've been riding the bus for a long time. I've watched a lot of buses being driven. I've paid careful attention to those other bus drivers. And I really think I got this and I think I can handle it.
I swear to God, Scott, that's like how my career as a restaurant GM started.
Yeah. Well, you started at like the, you know, ass end of the restaurant industry, slinging shitty Pizza Hut pies. And now look at you. Look at you.
Yeah, I've graduated out of the restaurant industry, yeah, as now, we all must do someday.
Now you, well, Jamie, it seems like the restaurant industry is a very nurturing and supportive place for people. And it's definitely financially rewarding and not exploitative about labor at all.
It's terrible.
It's not great.
It's not good at all. And it fucking breaks your body. And like specifically is cited by Daniel Brennan, this winemaker, was like, when the band stopped touring that he was managing, he was like, well, I can't be in restaurants the rest of my life. It's not sustainable. And he says it matter-of-factly because it's fucking matter-of-fact. Like, yeah. You can't. You cannot do it.
It's not a young person's game. Or it is a young person's
it's
game.
It's exclusively a young person's game.
Yeah. Ain't nobody else got the stamina for that shit. And, you know, older people get wiser and have bills to pay.
And want to see the people that they love every now and then.
What are you talking about, Jamie?
Podcast with their friend?
You loved missing out on years of parties and weekend gatherings and outings and things. That was your favorite. You loved declining every single Facebook event invite because it was a Friday or Saturday night.
I will say this honestly and truly. It has meant the world to me over the years that those invites never stopped coming despite the fact that I declined every single one of them. I always expected at some point the invites would stop.
They would just dry up.
Yeah. And they never did.
Well, people like you, Jamie. Despite yourself, we like you.
Somehow, someway.
And despite ourselves, yeah, we like you anyway.
Despite yourselves, really.
Mostly despite myself, yeah.
Yes. You got a question about this wine for
me,
right?
Well, I have some thoughts. So Jamie is providing me some research materials, dear audience listening at home. He still will not provide me with food pairings or opening, bottling, or chilling instructions of any variety, but at least I'll get some materials from behind the paywall. But so Jamie sent me a little bit of research, and I read something about the soils of this region, and I'm confused.
Okay. Talk to me.
So, remind me again, what is the region?
It's Gimblet Gravels.
Gimblet Gravels. So in Gimblet Gravels, and Jamie, you didn't tell me where this came from, so it's your fault that I can't attribute it to any particular website. Due to its free-draining soils, vines cannot survive without daily irrigation. Luckily, aquifers underneath the deep gravel beds provide plentiful water. The soils are low in nutrients, and as a result, winemakers must be vigilant to avoid stuck ferments caused by a lack of nitrogen, and to ensure that fermenting wines receive plenty of oxygen. So my question to you is, that sounds like an awful lot of fucking trouble to deal with. It sounds like these soils are not good, and you have to irrigate the areas and do an awful lot of labor to counter the fact that the soils do not want to hold on to the water.
Yep.
Why? Is there a trade-off? And why couldn't we just do this elsewhere where the soil does retain water? This just feels like a lot of trouble.
Well, I'm compelled to give you first a glib answer, which is, it's really hard making movies. Why don't we just do it an easier way?
Well, but they do find easier ways. That's why all the Marvel movies are shot in a parking lot in Atlanta with green screens everywhere. Like, they find easier ways. We don't need to go anywhere. This movie, the Normandy beach sequences, Doug Liman wanted to shoot on a location, maybe not at, like, you can't shoot at Normandy. It's a right. fucking historical site, but like on beaches somewhere. And it was just too expensive. So they filmed it on the studio back lot. And they built like a huge, no, but it looks great.
It does
like,
look great.
It's filmed outdoors. They created a fake beach. They, you know, flooded part of it for all the water areas. Like, it's outdoors. It's real. It looks great. But like, yeah, you find easier ways to do things. We don't all need to be Steven Spielberg taking a mechanical shark out into the, you know, Martha's Vineyard waters and just watching it sink immediately and then say, let's keep trying for 6 more months. Like, they find easier ways.
Yeah.
This doesn't seem like anyone is looking for an easier way.
Well, the easier way is using irrigation. The harder way is allowing the vines to grow naturally to such a point that the tap roots actually get to the aquifers underneath the ground.
Okay.
And that, in my opinion, is the better way, but it's hard because the vines have to be a certain age to get there, and they need to be nurtured along the way.
All right, but so you still have to irrigate. But aren't there soils that are not free-draining soils?
Yes.
Like, are those better to grow in?
Well, they're better for vegetative growth, and they're better for yield. But as we've mentioned before—
And I definitely retained.
Lower yield generally equals higher quality.
Oh, we did just talk about
that. Yeah.
Okay, fair.
You grow on marginal land specifically to make better wine is really the short answer here. In, let's say, Burgundy, because we're colonists and— it's a touchstone or whatever. The reason vines went in where they did is because you couldn't grow anything else there. It was marginal land that was useless for growing the primary thing that you need, which is food product. Right.
Yeah.
And so this vine survived. Cool. We can use this land to make wine. And it turned out that those are really great places to make wine. And the wines are delicious from there. When vines struggle, they make better wine. That's the short answer. That's the trade-off. And irrigate, to answer the next question, how common is irrigation?
Yeah.
Very. Not as much in Europe. There are a lot of laws on the book that prohibit irrigation.
Is this a T-word thing?
No, not really.
Irrigation doesn't get in the way of the T-word?
I mean, it does.
Because you got to dig up the soil.
No, you don't dig up the soil. You just like put irrigation lines up on the vines and it just drips.
This is not irrigation the way I'm thinking of irrigation, where like there's pipes running under the water to feed the
The pipes don't go under the ground. They go like they get attached to the vine rows.
Oh, this is much less difficult than I thought it was.
Yeah, it's not.
This doesn't feel like as big of a deal as I'm making it out to be then.
It is costly and it is labor intensive, mm-hmm. or it can be anyway, but it's the price you pay for having young vines in very difficult soil and needing economically to turn that into wine quickly, not having the benefit of older vines that were passed down to you from your father's 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 father.
So are they growing wines in these places with these free draining? Like, it always sounded to me like you were saying that this soil type is good for this type of wine and this soil type is this, but are they really just picking over the available tillable land that nobody wanted for food production? Is that what you mean by marginal soil?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, do I think that that happens today? Not as much.
Right.
But when, you know, in historical times, when fine wine was only a thing for kings and it was just like, we need to have some vines around so the people can get drunk every now and then and we can purify water also, the primary thing was still food. So you would plant the food crops in very, very good soil and your marginal land would be for the grapes because there it's a hardier crop.
I feel as though you have more than adequately answered my question and have rid me of several of my illusions about what words mean.
You're welcome.
Grand. Well, I feel like we should move on to the takes. Do you want to hear some takes?
Are they wife takes?
They are.
Are they going to trouble me this time?
The first one, maybe.
Okay, cool. Let's do it.
The second one, maybe not so much. Ooh, and then discussion questions. Classic wife. All right, so we're getting into wife takes. This is the age-old podcast game recreating my wife Tani's favorite way to antagonize James at his restaurants, which would be to come up with absurdly pretentious and flowery descriptions of the wines he served us to mock him and his delicate somm sensibilities. Now, normally we would do a version of wife takes that is two truths and a lie, but instead, for this miniseries, it's the end of the world, etc., etc., we're going with some weird shit. So, the first question she is posing to you here, Jamie Jim Jam, in which of the following ways do you, James Harrison Rubin, die in this alien apocalypse situation?
Oh, joy.
So specifically, the alien invasion as presented by Edge of Tomorrow, Live, Die, Repeat.
Yes.
One, you die as cannon fodder. Two, squashed by an alien.
Okay.
I'm going to do a little rewrite there and say two, squashed by one of your own dropships falling out of the sky.
That poor guy.
While you pilot a robot suit naked. Man fights balls out. Three, executed for desertion. I like that one.
Yeah, I mean, it's number three. It's definitely.
Yeah, it's definitely number three. Or four, alcohol poisoning.
Three.
Three. She says, given the mechanics of the movie, safe to say all of the above and repeatedly.
Wow.
But I'm going to overrule here and say 100% it's three. You would be executed for desertion.
That's correct. Not only would I desert, but I would get caught.
Oh, yeah. Well, definitely.
And also, by the way, you too. You would also desert and get caught.
Executed for desertion? No, I would not. I would do the Bill Gage thing, or the Bill Cage thing. And I would try and talk my way out of it. And then I would just end up demoted and strapped into a robot suit without anyone telling me how to turn the safety off my weapon. But then I wouldn't get time powers and right, I would just die. But I would also get squashed by a dropship that fell out of the sky.
You would desert.
But I would try, but I would passively desert. I would talk about deserting and then just make someone mad. All right, next question.
Next question.
Which movie element does this wine most evoke?
Okay.
Number one, the spastic yet compelling violence of the mimics.
No.
No, I don't agree. Two, the satisfaction of achieving a goal after multiple failed attempts.
Maybe.
Three, the lithe competence of Emily Blunt augmented by the structure and assertiveness of the exosuit.
Huh. I did describe this wine as live.
You did. I feel like you have to go.
I'm a little bit pigeonholed, but is there a fourth?
There's just three.
Just three? Okay, then I'm going with number three.
Our answer is probably number three because I put a lot of wine words in there. But she says,
damn it, Tani.
She says she would give you partial credit for number two, which is the satisfaction of achieving a goal after multiple failed attempts, depending on the vintner's backstory. Well, Jamie, I'm not grading you on the wife takes game. You showed up. You had a joke and you had a good, serious answer for the one question. So yes. Well done.
Thank you very much.
All right.
So the pairing.
The pairing.
We've arrived at the time when we discuss the pairing.
The pairing. Does the movie work with the wine? Does the wine complement or reflect the movie?
All right. So you gave me a whole big dissertation about this movie.
I said a lot of things.
You said a lot of stuff.
You copy-pasted it all here, and I don't want to read it all.
Right.
Because there's a lot.
And you're lazy.
Well, that, and I don't want to read it and then just cut it out later.
Right. And also, I only glommed onto a couple of things.
That's right.
Full disclosure, listener, I had a lot of trouble coming up with a pairing for this movie.
Yeah.
Partly because Scott gave me just a ton of things.
You're welcome.
And I didn't find any cohesiveness in any of it, or at least as much that I could glom on and make a pairing out of. So this was the last out of this six movie miniseries that I locked in a pairing for. And the two things that I really glommed onto of the myriad things that Scott said,
right,
were that this movie has a gee whiz sense of discovery, which I think I've already kind of made the case for the gee whiz sense of discovery in this wine. And David Brennan's sort of attitude and his ability to take whatever fruit comes his way and turn it into something great. And then the other thing is that it owes something to the Matrix. And that, by the transitive property in my head, because we covered the Matrix with Cloudy Bay, Sauvignon Blanc, this wine owes something big to Cloudy Bay.
Right.
Which, again, I've already made the case for. This comes out of a climate of big business supporting the ideas and ambitions of smaller producers. So conceptually, those are the two things that I went with.
Right.
Now, do I think that synesthetically, in the glass, on the screen, do these two things work together? I think a little bit. I don't think there's anything huge. I think that this is what I've said before, which is two really good things next to each other,
right,
being a very enjoyable experience.
Would you call this a serious wine?
I would, yes.
That's the only problem I'm having. Like, yeah, they're two superlative things that go well together because good things are good together. But this wine is serious. And the movie for the end of the world stakes and for the pathos of your TC character and for his like emotional stakes, it's not really a serious movie. Like, it's pretty light and fast and loose with the end of the world stakes. And many of the emotional stakes are like, you're largely safeguarded against by the repetition of everything. So like the stakes don't have to feel too heavy. And so anyway, I think the movie leans more on like action comedy,
right,
than like action drama or action thriller. And I feel like maybe the seriousness of this is kind of not gelling there.
The construction and craft of the movie, though, is pretty serious.
It is, but a lot of it's in service of jokes.
That's fair. And yes, I agree with you. The seriousness of this wine, it's hewn, it's constructed. It's, you can tell, A, that this wine will age, B, that this wine has a place in a fine dining restaurant. This would be an easy choice, or it has been an easy choice for me in putting it on lists in fine dining places that I've worked. I think maybe a better pair for this movie from the same winemaker would be his Giunta bottling that I mentioned earlier, the Malbec Nouveau, which is done specifically to be light, fruity, easy breezy.
Yeah, I mean, that would sit very nicely with this Wile E. Coyote cartoon of a movie.
Right. It still has that kind of the like dark fruited character of this wine while also having kind of a bubblegum, airy, floral kind of character to it. I think that would maybe be a better fit.
Yeah. I mean, we should address, because as you said, I did overload you with things to say about this movie. hoping you would find some to glom onto.
He one of the things he said was the nature of bravery, which definitely this movie is about.
It is about
that. I don't know how I could possibly translate that into wine.
I was throwing shit at the table. Or I was throwing shit at the wall and see what was going to stick. Yeah. But so the only thing that it really owes to the Matrix is I think there is a straight line from the design of the Sentinels in the Matrix to the mimic alien robot thing in this movie. And in really not too many other ways is this on any kind of continuum with the Matrix.
I agree with that.
Yeah. Like, I mean, there's things like structurally in the industry and like the types of hard sci-fi movies that started to get made at a certain budget level as a result of the Matrix's success. But like otherwise, this is not really in any kind of continuity with that movie.
Yeah. So maybe this is like a solid C pairing.
Jimmy, I gave you so many other things to glom onto except for the Matrix thing.
You did. Blend of tones that shouldn't work. Rad robot suits.
It's got rad robot suits.
It does.
I mean, I don't know how this helps you as a wine, but I think you're not ever going to get a better pitch for this movie than what if the first 20 minutes of Saving Private Ryan, except it lasts 2 hours long and it's an alien invasion and a video game and a Looney Tune. But that doesn't help you as a wine.
It doesn't.
That doesn't really do anything
for
you.
But it's a great pitch for the movie.
And it is.
If you haven't, better you should than watch this fucking movie.
Edge of Tomorrow, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, I really like this wine a lot, and I like this movie a lot.
I like this wine a lot, too.
It's delicious.
It's mega tasty. You don't have to convince me. I'm drunk now, and I've had a glass of it. And a
bottle of Cloudy Bay before.
I had like half a bottle of Cloudy Bay before.
Great.
So pairing. Verdict on pairing. It's a shrug?
Yeah.
Wine is very good.
Yep.
People should find it and drink it.
Movie's very good. You should watch it.
Yeah. But do they go well together? I don't know. Tell us. Watch them, drink them, DM Jamie or something. I don't know how we get feedback from people.
Mostly DMs.
Right. So, Jamie, what if people like this wine? What if they want more? Pour them some more, Jamie. More. GIF of Adam Driver screaming more as Kylo Ren.
It's a good GIF.
It's a great GIF.
Yeah.
More!
So I think that it's easy to not love Malbec because like there's a veritable sea of garbage Malbec that comes out of Argentina.
But not a literal sea of garbage Malbec.
No.
So I feel like even if it's garbage Malbec, you would really get down on going for a dip in that ocean.
It's true. Huh? It's very true. Huh? But having said that, Argentina is a really great place for growing Malbec. And I think that there are some really interesting producers doing great things, not on the bulk level. One of those guys is Carmelo Patti, who is a Sicilian immigrant to Argentina. His personal label, which is just Carmelo Patti, comes from the Luján de Cuyo subregion of Mendoza. It's awesome. I think it's the archetype for what Malbec should taste like. It's kind of structured the way this is, but even more sort of serious. It's definitely steakhouse wine.
Mm.
I sold a ton of it, incidentally, when I worked at a steakhouse.
Steakhouse wine.
It's super fucking good. His other bottling, which is much, much more difficult to find, is called Finca Adalgisa. And if you find it, buy it, drink it. It's delicious. But the base Carmelo Patti Malbec from Luján de Cuyo is really awesome and is $40 at vivino.com. Mm,
that's a lot.
I disagree.
Okay, that's fine.
What's your double feature for this movie, Scott?
A little double feature action? Well, if you're down with funky and clever time loop type movies, this is one of my favorites that I saw this year. This is a 2020 film that only started making the U.S. festival rounds, I guess, this year. This is from Japan. The filmmaker's name is, I believe, Junta Yamaguchi, and it is called Beyond the Infinite 2 Minutes. Anyone who happened to hear our episodes that dropped during the recent Philadelphia Film Festival heard me doing a plug for that movie as an ad read. It is a 75-minute long time loop, one-shot, real-time comedy.
What?
In which a guy who owns a cafe wraps up work for the night, camera follows him out of the cafe, up 2 flights of stairs into his apartment, and he goes in and he turns on his computer, and on his monitor is the closed-circuit like security feed from his restaurant downstairs, except it's him on the screen. And he's saying, hey, it's me. I'm you. 2 minutes from now, we've created a time loop. And then he goes back downstairs and then sees himself 2 minutes ago. And then his employees and his friends get involved. And then it gets crazier and wilder and weirder. And if you like all of the shit that I loved about Edge of Tomorrow, the very clever, like, visual and screenwriting and editing ways that they convey complex ideas to you mm-hmm. in a way that is breathless and exciting and like you were saying, like, gee whiz, like, fun to watch and discover as it's unfolding. Man, this movie is for you, and you don't have to bring any of your complicated Tom Cruise baggage to it. And it is, I think, 75 minutes long.
That sounds all the way up my alley.
It is so great. It is currently not available as of this recording, not really available in the U.S. anywhere. I saw it virtually through the Nightstream Film Festival. There's a region-free Blu-ray that is in the works, I think, from Arrow Video. But just, like, put this thing on your lists. Keep an eye out for it. If we see that it becomes available, we will tell people, whoever is following us on the socials. So do that. But beyond the infinite 2 minutes, I absolutely adore this movie. And if you dug the stuff in this movie that I dug so much, I really think people would love this movie. Right. You, Jamie, would very much enjoy this movie.
The pitch is speaking to me.
Yeah.
Very much.
It is so fucking funny and so clever. And it probably cost $5 to make it. Like, it's an iPhone movie.
Right.
Like, it's shot on an iPhone and it's all meant to look like one take in real time through crazy time nanigans. And it's just
time nanigans.
It's special, dude. It's real fucking
good. I'm into it.
Yeah.
Drink a bottle of Carmelo Patti Malbec while watching it.
Well, we'll have to track it down. And maybe I'll get that region free Blu-ray.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
So, Scott.
James.
It's the end of the world as we know it.
As we know it.
And I want wine.
You want wine.
But that's also the name of our miniseries.
Ah, interesting. All right. You're doing a little callback there. That's good.
That's right.
Yeah.
So tell us, what is next in this miniseries? What flavor of world-ending event are we talking about next?
Well, we're trending away from things that are giving me real dread. So, like, nuclear apocalypse at the behest of, you know, professional warmongers who are eager for all of us to die. Pretty afraid of that. Giant monsters that are coming to destroy us and we're totally fucked because it's up to the bureaucrats and politicians to save us. Pretty afraid of that too.
We're not afraid of the monster as much as we are the incompetence of the systems.
That is correct.
Yes.
Robot apocalypse, AI uprising, a little bit afraid of AI uprising, but it feels like it's already happened. And as you mentioned previously, that, you know, the whole AI uprising is also tied in with the rise of social media and the internet and the algorithm and the destruction of any of our agreed upon facts.
All of us on social media.
Very much afraid of all of those things. And then alien invasion. Nah, I'm kind of cool with that. There's no aliens. It's fine. We're fine. There's no aliens. Thing I'm even less afraid of than alien invasion is zombie apocalypse.
Zombie apocalypse.
So we're moving into more of a comfort zone for me, except that anytime I think about a zombie apocalypse, what I immediately think about is that in a zombie apocalypse, I don't really have any demonstrable skills. And therefore I would not be on anyone's call list for, oh shit, it's the zombie apocalypse. You know, get a baseball bat and a rake and meet me in the truck and we're going to go to, you know.
Same. Me too.
Yeah. I would just be left behind and no one.
You and I would fend for ourselves.
It would be pretty bad.
And we would become zombies.
Right. So all of that preamble leads us to, we are watching 2004's all-time great comedy, Edgar Wright's Shaun of the Dead.
Fuck yes.
Edgar Wright's Shaun of the Dead, written by Wright with Simon Pegg. It stars Pegg. It stars Nicholas Frost. It is the first of their unofficial Cornetto trilogy. Three movies that those three Brits made together that are comedies riffing in different genres. And this one is, as the marketing from Focus Features accurately quoted it, a rom-zom-com. It is not a parody of zombie movies. It is a zombie movie that is also a comedy.
Love this movie so much.
So good.
Also, if you don't love this movie, don't fucking talk to me.
Jamie, I feel like nobody doesn't love Shaun of the Dead.
There's got to be some mouth breather out there. Well, I mean, I'm going to do the bad reviews. We're going
to
find it.
I'm going to challenge you to do something other than that because I don't want to hear people slag Shaun of the Dead. Anyway, we're watching Shaun of the Dead. As of this recording, it is only available for your rental pleasures. We will, of course, update people if it becomes available through other means. But check it out. Shaun of the Dead. I have it upstairs. It's waiting for me to crack it open and watch it. Jamie, what are you pairing with this delightful Ramsam-Kam?
We're going to Austria, yeah?
I mean,
we're not going there, but we're drinking wine from there.
We're not going anywhere.
It would be nice to go to Austria, though. I hear Vienna is lovely.
It would be nice to go anywhere.
Yes, that's right now, that's Jamie. Correct. Anyway, we're going with just an awesome, awesome producer of Gruner Veltliner from the Comptal in Austria. This is Fred Leumer's base Gruner Veltliner. The 2019, it's available at wine.com for $25. It is at once easygoing and zippy and also like deadly serious and ageable and beautiful. I fucking love this wine.
I'm feeling pretty good about this pairing coming up.
Yeah.
Because the thing about Sean is that it's a silly, goofy, ridiculous comedy. But it's also fucking real.
And
when they go for the emotional stakes, it's real.
Yep.
And it has aged extremely well.
It sure has. I think the last time I watched it was like just pre-pandemic, like 2019.
Oof. Oof. Shaun of the Dead, 2019, Leumer, Gruner, Veltliner, Comptal, Austria. Can you try all that for the audience
you
now?
You did great, honey. 2019 Leumer Gruner Veltliner from Comptal, Austria.
Drink it, watch it. Please listen.
For the love of God.
Please.
Thank you everyone for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks all of you.
Please follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. If you have questions or concerns, feel free to email us at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com or slide into either of our DMs.
Only Jamie's DMs. Please don't DM me.
DM Scott. He gets uncomfortable.
I don't know how to work Instagram DMs. I'm very confused by them.
Make sure you rate, review, and follow the show wherever you get your podcasts and spread the word via the old-fashioned method, word of mouth.
Tell your friends. If you like the show, your friends are kind of like you, and they'll probably like the things that you like. So tell them about the show, and then they'll like the show, and then they'll tell their friends. This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That is me. Our social media presence is thanks to the tireless efforts of one James Harrison Rubin. That is him sitting right across from me. He's about to tell you that his name is not James.
My name's not James. I'll show you my birth certificate. It's Jamie.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone, remember to drink more wine and watch more movies. It's good for you. We promise.
And if you happen to find yourself in a time loop hellscape in which you cannot possibly escape any type of scenario, you know, just remember, follow Emily Blunt and you'll probably be okay.
Or she'll steal your battery and leave you for dead.
Man, she's great. Emily Blunt leaving me for dead is like a fetish I didn't know I had. I'm learning a whole lot about myself here.
Wow, that's weird and fucked up.
That's a great place to end it. Good night, everybody.
Good night, y'all.
Sorry about all the Tom Cruise talk.
You are once again a ray of sunshine.
Jamie.
Just a joyful
you
sprite in my everyday life.
Both hear the same alarming predictions and prognostications about climate change. Do you really think that aliens will get here before we've drowned ourselves?
No, I don't.
No, and I
every
do not
time
either.
I hear another recording of the blessed, blessed soul. Carl Sagan saying, if we don't destroy ourselves first, we may reach the stars.
Right.
That the first part of that sentence hangs a little bit heavier every time.
Yeah. Well, Carl got out while the getting was good.
He sure did.